forum for frank talk about what people do for a living. Work Stew.
Hello and welcome to Work Stew. It's July 8th, 2012, and this is episode number 41. I'm Kate Gase Walton. I'm the editor of Work Stew, an online collection of essays and interviews in which people ponder their work lives. In this episode, I talked to researcher Evelyn Chen. I connected with Evelyn after posting a link to an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education called "Why Are Associate Professors So Unhappy?" As someone who has worked in tenure-track positions, achieved tenure, and then chosen to move on as an independent researcher, Evelyn has an interesting perspective on life in academia. The interview starts with Evelyn explaining how, after studying philosophy at Harvard as an undergraduate, she went on to the University of Virginia to get her PhD in literature.
I took this really great graduate class in my senior year with a professor, and she was doing some literature, and so I ended up going to UVA and getting my PhD in literature, and then ended up getting a teaching job. And everyone told me not to take this teaching job, actually, because it was in a tiny place. But I was really attracted by the music school because I'd always loved to sort of, as an amateur, play music, and I was sort of entranced by the idea of being gainfully employed, not being in school, and it was at a time when a lot of people were complaining about jobs, and I just felt like, well, I got a job, you know, gonna go for it.
Right. So where were you then?
At the University of Hartford. So I stayed at Hartford for 5 years, and I developed a program in hip-hop music composition, and actually at Minnesota I brought it there, and my TA became the first, like, a professor in the first ever hip-hop program, national program at McNally Smith College. And, you know, I found out that a lot of the really creative and cutting-edge things were going on at, like, what really snotty people would call no-name universities. At what I would call just universities was, I mean, the University of Harvard had a lot of money. A lot of my kids' parents had never been to college. So it was really fascinating to be in a totally different environment where not everybody had all the answers. And I had felt, and I actually felt almost more comfortable there than I had felt in a long time. You know, even, I wasn't a natural at Harvard. I think I was one of those awkward people who was just shocked to be there, like, half the time.
No, I'm laughing because that was entirely my experience.
I tried every angle of explanation as to what they were and what I wasn't, and I still couldn't figure out why I was so different. And I'm not saying different in a good way either, because, you know, these were people who were becoming like CEOs of Facebook, you know, and I wasn't on that wavelength, but I wasn't, like, you know, out of touch or not a people person or something like that. I couldn't get away with the eccentric genius thing either.
You know, darn.
Bizarre and kind of, yeah, because I was actually just kind of a down-to-earth kind of person.
Well, and I wonder, at Hartford, do you think that part of it was because there weren't all the expectations that a place like Harvard has? Do you think it actually allows for more creativity in a way? Did you feel that?
Yeah, I do believe you're absolutely right about the lack of expectation. I mean, I went there. You know, nobody had heard of the people I had worked with. You know, or if they had heard of them, they were just sort of these, like, really strange, like, you know, they didn't really recognize that they were alive or something.
So coming back to your early academic career, it sounds like your time at Hartford was really quite fulfilling. Were there things that you didn't like about it?
I think what I didn't like was the structure that's implicit in schools that aren't built for research. I mean, I remember that I was holding office hours sometimes at midnight, mm-hmm. just trying to see students who had, like, irregular schedules. And so I was working all the time because I was teaching a three load and trying to get my book out and trying to launch this music program. There were things that were difficult because it wasn't set up to be a research institution, and there was very little in the way of time off I really needed.
Right.
And that was my main motivation for leaving, actually.
So that article that I posted from the Chronicle of Higher Education about unhappy associate professors, did that resonate with you?
Yeah, it really did, because it may be the reason why I'm not in a formal academic setting in America anymore. It resonated with me in that, you know, I knew that once I'd gotten tenure that you were supposed to all of a sudden be on a lot of committees. And, you know, there were people who were probably more well-known than I was who would sort of get out of that responsibility. And then there were people who, you know, it sort of, you saw certain categories of people who were ahead of you, and people would fall into, like, the soldiers who did everything for the department, the researchers who got off scot-free and just taught graduate seminars. You know, I started to see this sort of cynicism about responsibilities and who got what, and it became, you know, how do you assess merit and who gets off scot-free and who can negotiate the best salary. And, you know, I think that to a certain extent academia is going to be corporatized, you know, and that's fine because I think it needs to be. But I did think that the people who were doing the judging about who gets what and the people who were really the best in negotiating, it wasn't about the merit of their own academic work at that point. It was about the merit of them being really, really cunning about how to negotiate deals. And that's what I didn't like. Whereas, you know, if you look at, for instance, science, which is really much more structured than humanities, most of the lab heads have to apply for their funding. So the granting agencies, okay, I admit that there's probably some similar political sort of influence going on, but they have granting committees where everybody discusses the grant proposal. And to keep alive, they have to apply to grants. And so they get judged on academic standards that are formalized, you know, according to these committees. Whereas your salary as a professor of literature or whatever is totally dependent on, you know, how well you can sort of convince the head honcho that you deserve like twice the salary of somebody who's doing potentially equally good academic work. But that's what I most sort of became cynical by, but I don't think that, I still think that universities are utopias, resorts even, incredible resources to both students and faculty and researchers. But despite that, I do think that the shape of humanities has to change. There have been complaints over the years. There's no discipline to the discipline. And I don't think that that's simply a matter of not being any discipline to this area of study. I think there's no discipline to the structure and to the way in which funding is directed, because the guidelines for the humanities have remained so vague. And honestly, there's a little bit of laziness involved.
And do you see a path to applying the same kind of rigor that you see in the sciences to the humanities? Do you see that as something that's possible?
And it's because I believe in ideas so strongly. I think that if you have a really, really great idea, and if it resonates, it'll resonate to a committee, and they will give you funding, and you can come up with a team and work on an idea with the same kind of precision and passion and drive, and incorporate other people into it. Instead of the book, which you're supposed to write, which is often a solitary entity, which often takes way longer than it should. You know, it's not like I don't believe in books, because I really do. But I also believe in teamwork, and I think teamwork can maybe make a better publication than a solitary unit. That's been my experience. And, you know, I think the typical model is to write your monograph, then do a compilation of essays on the subject that you have to sort of prove that you are collegial, and then do another monograph. You know, instead of that, why not just get a project that everybody can work on? And why don't you have that project be a dissemination of different media as opposed to just simply a monograph? You know, we've got a lot of virtual stuff. We've got, you know, and if you can justify that and provide a great plan and get funding for that, I do believe that we could have teams of researchers and students involved and some teaching. But we don't have to have this is specifically a plan for research institutions, much less than for, you know, and to a certain extent this happens in top research. organizations. You do have grants which allow you to take a year off for this or that, but they don't often incorporate other people. And I think there's probably now a trend towards that. I've been out of U.S. academia for a couple of years.
So back to your life story, you got tenure, and then you've sort of walked away from it. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. And I think that has to do with coming to France and discovering this whole world of people at the University of Lyon and finding a team of people who were working intensely on Asia. And I really wanted to be working on China and the sort of art movement that was going on there, the history of it, of that art movement, because it was an avant-garde art movement. I'd gotten really interested in these Chinese-American artists who I was, like, one in particular who I was interviewing in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And I found that it sort of led to this whole exercise and, like, relearning some Chinese. And so that was really great, and I just thought, I'm not going to be able to do that at Minnesota right now. Not that there aren't great Chinese scholars, because there are, and I run into them actually now, and I ran into one in Taiwan this year, but it just wasn't, I just didn't see it happening if I actually was going to stay there and develop this music interest, which I had actually brought to Amsterdam on a semester off there and also had ended up bringing it to Paris and to Lyon as well.
And was it literally, you know, the geography that you needed to be somewhere else to do this kind of work, or was it something about being a professor there that meant you'd be spending your time on all sorts of other tasks? What made you think it wasn't possible?
I think it was one of those weird, well, I'd been spending like sort of a few months every year in Paris and in Lyon with different people. I'd been teaching some seminars in Lyon, and they had a great setup there. They had like a full library. They had scholars whose interests meshed with mine, and they were interested in what I was doing. And there in Minnesota, I kind of, again, I kept running into this attitude. I ran into someone there who said, you know, academics is kind of a sinecure. Or, you know, they were saying things that I just thought, wow, you know, this is not the way I want to view my academic life. I think it's not a job, it's sort of a life choice. I mean, you know, if I think that separates, like, the person who can do a great job at something and the person who does a good job. Like, the person who does a great job, there's just no separation between their life and their work. And people say that's unhealthy, but I don't think it is. I think if you like your work, then it's clearly not.
Right. So you mentioned in your note to me that you see these universities as going through a transformation now. So how would you characterize that transformation?
Well, there's when I was still at Minnesota, and that was up until 2010, and like I said, I've been traveling back and forth to Paris since several years before that. So I think that there's a lot more emphasis on applying for funding, and if you want research time, you've got to really work for it. I think there's potentially more punitive measures for people who aren't going to be updating themselves, writing more, using more technology. There are much more stringent rules on the young professors that are coming up, and that's just so that, you know, it's just getting harder to pass tenure, I think. And I think all those things are good things. I mean, I know that I probably get sort of tarred and feathered for saying that, but I think it's necessary.
And what about independent study, the kind of independent research that you're doing? Do you see other people taking that path as well?
Well, for instance, a friend of mine who was a junior fellow at Harvard, and he's an evolutionary biologist, he was my class at Harvard. He left the Santa Fe Institute, which is a very, very creative place to do science, and he felt that he needed to really go solo to do exactly what he wanted to do, because he does these, you know, science cartoons, and he writes poetry, and he's just, you know, a very multi-talented person. You know, he felt like he needed more freedom to do what he wanted, and so now he's independently applying for funding on his own, and he started an institute, which I'm a member of as well, a very recent member, and we don't know how this thing's going to pan out. But it looks potentially very cool, where you get a bunch of independent scholars who can crossbreed and cross-pollinate ideas and also apply for their own funding.
And what are the sources for funding in that kind of situation?
Well, for instance, I was just on a Fulbright. You know, that's a somewhat solitary form of funding because the scholar applies themselves for Fulbright. And there are pockets out there, like the Guggenheim, which, you know, I don't think it's based on whether you have a position or not. There's much more than I know. I haven't been looking at U.S. funding so much because I'm in Europe and I'm sort of tied to European funding at this point.
It almost sounds like you envision, and maybe you're actually living in a situation where researchers doing academic work may be able to pursue that outside of academic institutions, that it's just, the entrepreneurial academic.
Yeah, and you see that as well. You see these books coming out of Norton. You see these books coming out of a variety of different, even academic publishers, but even trade publishers. And they're extremely in-depth, and they're by people who are sort of known as writers, in quotes. You know, these writers are doing high-level research, extremely deep research that, some of them are from universities, but some of them are completely going solo, and they're finding things that other people in academia wouldn't have the sort of structure to find because they're all on their own, and they've managed to find funding or find a way of life because they're either writing and making money out of the essays that they're generating, or they're, finding independent funding for their project because their project is cool. And I think that's just another structure that humanities people can consider. And I know that I'm not going to be totally popular after this conversation, but it's it's definitely putting a really tough standard on an already tough job, which is, how do you educate? But, I had colleagues, one in particular who told me, hey, I feel like I'm teaching to kids who don't want to read in the way that I'm reading. She looked at me and she said, I feel like I'm teaching a skill that's useless. And, unfortunately, what hurt about that comment to everybody in the room was that it was true. You're picking up, a book that has been taught in universities for the last two decades, and you're reading it in a really anachronistic manner because, it was written and analyzed, pre-internet. I'm not saying there's no value to that because I love literature dating back to, the 18th century and even beyond. But our methods for analysis, now they've got something at Harvard called culturonomics, and, I've been dabbling in some of that. How do you use these tools to look at how things have changed? You've got these insane macro tools that can actually analyze things in an efficient, interesting, fascinating way. And the combination of that powerful technology and the human analysis, which is really, really important too, is what's going to be like the cutting edge part of education, not simply one person's thought about something, because we're not solo anymore. We're all connected, and that should be acknowledged. The students won't believe it otherwise because it's not their world.
That wraps up the interview for today. Thanks again very much to my guest, Evelyn Chen. Thanks also to everyone who has contributed an essay to Work Stew. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening today. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks, and I hope you'll check it out. In the meantime, please let me know what you thought of the interview by sending an email to kate@workstew.com, by posting a comment on the Work Stew website, or by writing a review for iTunes. Thanks again, and bye for now.